It is our custom to pause a few moments for silent prayer before beginning our class. This affords you the opportunity to utilize the privacy of your priesthood and rebound if necessary, and to leave all of your problems checked at the door for concentration on our study this morning. With these things in mind, shall we pray? Heavenly Father, we are indeed grateful to you for the power of the Scriptures and the ability you've given us through the power of the Spirit to understand its content. As we continue our examination of the passage that you have selected for us today, it is our prayer that through the system that you have developed, we might be able to find insight into the Christian way of life, that we might be able to better identify our own failures so that we might recover, and that we might be able to defend our souls against the assaults of the outside adversities of both the SWAT team and Cosmos Diabolicus. It is to that end that our prayer is, our spiritual growth therefore might continue, and we lift our prayer in the name of Christ our Savior. Amen. As you know, we are working our way down the Santa Fe Trail. We've been reading excerpts from Josiah Gregg's Commerce on the Prairies, and in a recent excerpt we noted a little episode involving rattlesnakes, mustangs, and mules. And from that we noted the doctrine of iconoclastic arrogance. It is a study that we're presently advancing through. We began in paragraph one with a definition of terms, all of which you should be familiar with by now. The second paragraph was the development of iconoclastic arrogance. An example, a fictitious member of a congregation who is in self-righteous arrogance. And that leads, of course, to iconoclastic arrogance. The third paragraph was a dissertation on unrealistic expectations. That is what sets up the feet of clay syndrome, role model arrogance, and then iconoclastic arrogance. The fourth paragraph, iconoclastic arrogance illustrated from 2 Samuel 13, verses 20 through 29. That is where we find ourselves at the moment. Recently, in our study of that passage, we noted last Sunday morning, first session, verses 20 through 21. And then in the second session, we compared verse 21 with the Septuagint. On Tuesday, we noted verses 21 in analysis and then verse 22. And from that, we noted both the feet of clay syndrome and role model arrogance. On Thursday evening, our subject was preparation for an assassination, verses 23 through 25. Our corrected translation in those six verses are as follows. 2 Samuel 13, verse 20. Then her brother, her here being Tamar, who has been raped by her half-brother Amnon, then her brother, her full brother Absalom, said to her, "Has your brother Amnon been with you?" Idiomatic for rape. "Now therefore, my sister, do not plan any revenge, for he is your brother. But this put this matter out of your mind." So Tamar remained as a recluse in the castle of her brother Absalom. Then verse 21. Now when King David heard all these things, he became extremely angry. He was upset over what his son Amnon had done to his daughter Tamar. He is the chief justice of the Israeli Supreme Court. He is the authority. He is the one delegated to execute justice for the law. We don't know any further what his thoughts were other than he was angry if we stay with the Masoretic text. But if we consult the Septuagint, 3rd century B.C. Greek translation of the Old Testament scriptures, we get a little further insight. The second sentence, the secret hidden sentence of verse 21, is as follows. But he did not trouble the life of Amnon his son. Did not trouble the life means he did not punish him in any way. The law required that he be executed. Obviously, from our passage, Amnon goes on living, and therefore he was not punished for his crime. He did not trouble the life of Amnon his son. The rationale? Because he loved him, and because he was the firstborn. At that point, Absalom moves into the emotional complex of sin. The first one that emerges is hatred, and from that he begins a downward spiral. From hatred, he moves into feet of clay syndrome, which has just been revealed by David. He did not live up to Absalom's expectations. He had made a role model out of his father. His father was his hero, which is normal to do, especially when your father is David, and especially when he is king of Israel, especially when a person of such great intelligence is your father. He is an aristocrat. He is royalty. It would be easy to make a role model and a hero out of such a person. Not only was he great politically and socially and personally, he was a military hero. He was a great musician. He wrote fantastic poetry, which was put to music. We know half of them as the Psalms. There are 75 Psalms written by David, most of them put to music. And he was just phenomenal in every possible way. So you can see it'd be fairly easy to make a role model out of such a personality. And that is what Absalom did. He considered his father to be perfect. He was able to maintain his emotions and his sin pattern after the rape of his sister, knowing that David would set things right. When David didn't, that was his feet of clay. Absalom looked on that and says, "You are no longer perfect. I must tear you down. You're not a worthy idol." And the iconoclastic arrogance process began at that point. He had unrealistic expectations for his father. When his father let him down, he began to implode. Now, all of that is signaled by verse 22. Absalom did not speak to Amnon, either good or evil, for Absalom hated Amnon because he had violated his sister Tamar. The fact that he did not speak to Amnon is significant. What is indicated here is aristocratic poise and grace under pressure, in the sense that he is utilizing this facade to camouflage his intentions of murder. And in verse 23, we see that 2 years later, when Absalom's sheep shearers were in Baal-Hazor, Absalom invited to a party all the sons of the king. For 2 years, he has conducted himself impeccably around the crown prince as well as his father David. He has left no indication whatsoever that he is unduly upset about the events which have transpired. He has used his aristocratic manners, bearing, and savoir-faire to convince everyone in the royal family that he holds no grudges and that he actually has no evil intentions. And so he invites people to a party at his sheep ranch in Baal-Hazor. And we'll note in a few minutes precisely where that is located. But it's 90 miles approximately north of Jerusalem. To get Amnon to Jerusalem so that he can murder him there is his objective and his hidden agenda. The rhetorical veil, therefore, comes out to be his good manners. That camouflages all he's up to. He wants to lure Amnon to Baal-Hazor so he can murder him there. Baal-Hazor is only a few miles from his grandfather's kingdom of Geshur, where he can seek political asylum. This is the plan. This is the plot. This is the scheme. Verse 24, Absalom went to the king and said, "Your servant has had shearers come. Will the king and his cabinet please join me?" Having shearers come is a way to tell David that the sheep are ready to be sheared, the pros are coming in to do the job. As soon as these tasks are done, the annual party will commence. several days' worth of hoopla on the range. And this is customary, happens every year. This is not a surprise to David. And therefore, the invitation is for David and his cabinet to join him at Baal Hazor. He has already invited his brothers to come. There is a small problem in that one brother, Amnon, is the crown prince and is therefore involved in the government of Israel. He is, in essence, a part of David's cabinet, and he would have to have a special release to leave Jerusalem to go to Baal Hazor. We know that David is going to refuse the invitation. His responsibilities would keep him in Jerusalem. His government would require that the cabinet stay there as well. He has no problem with the brothers going to Baal Hazor, as we'll note in today's study. Very interesting rationale there. And the only problem is to make sure that Amnon would be included among the other brothers. He is a part of the cabinet, and therefore there has to be special permission for him to leave Jerusalem. And so verse 24 again says, Absalom went to the king and said, Your servant has had hearers come. Will the king and his cabinet please join me? And then in verse 25, But the king said to Absalom, No, my son, all of us should not go, as we would be too burdensome to you. Although Absalom kept urging him to attend, David kept refusing to go, but offered his blessing. That's very important there, for we see that David says, No, we can't leave Jerusalem abandoned of all government and leadership. It's too far a journey. We couldn't get back in case of an emergency if we did that. You go ahead and have your party. It's all right with me. I offer you my blessings, which is David's seal of approval on the party. If David had had any misgivings about what might go on at Baal Hazor, then he says right here when he offers his blessings, I have no fear of what may go on. If I've nurtured any ideas that you might be holding some grudge against Amnon, at this point I realize that this is too out in the open for it to be an opportunity for you to execute anything. So it's fine with me to go ahead with the party and to invite the brothers up, and I hope you have a good time. There is one small piece of business that does need to be attended to. Absalom needs to ensure the fact that Amnon is released to go. And that's where we resume our study in verse 26. The corrected translation of that verse reads this way. Absalom said, If not, in other words, if you and your cabinet are not able to attend, please permit Amnon, my brother, to come with us. And the king said, Well, why should he go with you? Now, I think that this, obviously, is David double-checking. He's pretty content that things are going to go fairly smoothly because he has been invited to go. All of the major authorities in Jerusalem have been invited to go. All of the brothers have been invited to go. So why would Absalom be up to something with all that heat around? That doesn't make sense. But David, being a good leader, has one more bridge to cross. He needs to double-check Absalom's intention. So he asks, why should he go with you? Point one. The question by the king probably indicates that David is still concerned about whether Absalom has developed revenge motivation in his soul. Does Absalom still have a thing with regard to Amnon and the rape of Tamar? Things don't look on the surface to be a problem, but I need to double check. So he asked the question. Point two. Absalom had given no public indication of any such thing over the past 2 years. How long can you keep a straight face when you're up to something? Absalom did it for 2 years. How long can you tolerate and stomach and endure people you detest and, according to verse 22, hate, convincing them that everything is right and fine with you when you're up to something? Absalom was up to something, and this is his facade and his ability to to associate with people in a very poised and elegant way was the technique that he used to hide his hidden agenda. That was part of his subterfuge. That is a perfect word to describe Absalom's strategy. So under point three, let's define our word for the definition of subterfuge and synonym. Bring out precisely what Absalom is up to. Subterfuge is defined by Webster's Knight as follows. Deception by artifice or stratagem in order to conceal, escape, or evade. Deception by artifice or stratagem in order to conceal, escape, or evade. There are two words here in the definition that offer insight. The word artifice means insincere or false behavior. For 2 years, he's had insincere and false behavior as a rhetorical veil, as a visual veil. The word stratagem, a trick cleverly conceived for deceiving and outwitting the enemy. A trick cleverly conceived for deceiving and outwitting the enemy. And indeed, that is precisely what he has accomplished. There are two enemies, Amnon and David. David has been deceived. Amnon has no clue. And he is going to wind up going to the sheep-shearing party at Baal-Hazor. Deception by artifice or stratagem in order to conceal. He has very definitely been able to conceal his hidden agenda. Escape. Because he is able to pull it off at Baal-Hazor, he is able to seek political asylum just a couple of miles away in his grandfather's kingdom of Geshur. Evade. He is able to evade David's authority because he is able to keep him in Jerusalem along with all of the other members of the cabinet. This is perfect. It goes right along the plan that he has developed. He is going to be able to pull it off as he originally intended. Further on the definition, subterfuge suggests the adoption of a stratagem or the telling of a lie in order to escape guilt or to gain an end. Whatever means you have to utilize to gain an end are okay if the end, in your view, is the primary objective. This is the thinking of radical liberalism in our country today. It doesn't matter how corrupt the leadership is. It doesn't matter how immoral. It doesn't matter how wrong the leadership is, as long as we accomplish our end. The end justifies all means. We don't have to have any respect for ourselves or other people. We don't have to have any standards. We don't have to live up to any norms. The objective is to make a better world for everyone, where everyone can live as brothers. And once that's accomplished, there won't be any more problems. So the few bumps and bruises we have to go through in order to get there are worth it. Such is the case for Absalom as well. He has figured out how he can lie, how he can put up this rhetorical veil, how he can escape guilt, and how he can gain his end. Point four. Absalom wisely selected a well-known event for the timing of the assassination. This is something that goes on annually. He is involved in it annually. It is typical for him to invite people to the party. There is nothing unusual going on. Its location was so far removed from Jerusalem that he knew his father could not attend and that he would not permit his cabinet to do so. David's regret, therefore, allowed Absalom to then invite Amnon, and good manners did not permit the king to refuse. There was no rationale that would cause David to refuse this invitation, for Absalom has given him no reason, no legitimate reason to refuse the request. For 2 years, Absalom has behaved perfectly toward him and Amnon. Therefore, to refuse the request would therefore be an insult without cause. And David is not going to be there. Now, under point 5, let's note the irony of David's misapplication of authority. 5 subpoints. The irony of David's misapplication of authority. Subpoint 1. It was his misuse of authority that brought Bathsheba to his castle where he raped her. His misuse of authority is what brought Bathsheba to his castle where he raped her. 11 verse 4. 2 Samuel 11 verse 4, in what we might call a corrected and an expanded translation, trying to put it in what we might say 20th century vernacular so you can catch the drift of what David is up to here. David sent his state troopers and seized Bathsheba. And when she was brought to him, he raped her. Now, in exegesis, you can read your English translations there, and you say, well, how do we know that this is rape? How do we know that Bathsheba didn't go along? Look, you ladies are pampered in the United States of America, regardless of what Molly Yard tells you. You people are really equal with the men, if not superior to legally. There's nothing that you can say that anyone would twist or disbelieve. You can actually accuse any male or any white male of anything you want. If you can get into a court of law, you'll win. Doesn't matter if it's true or not. That's not the issue anymore. Whether it's true or not is not the issue. Can we advance the cause? That's the issue. So you ladies are really pampered. But in 10th century B.C. Israel, women were pretty much chattel. And when the king sent for you and his bodyguards, or his state troopers, went down there to get you and said, the king wants to see you in his hotel room, what are you going to say? Okay. You've got no choice. You go. And off she went. She had big men around her. And in that culture, she had to submit not only to male authority, but certainly to the king. So when she got to the castle, she was in no position to negotiate. No position to negotiate. She is in the boudoir of the king, and the king is going to give her some orders, so to speak, and she is going to be forced to submit. And we know from the next sentence in the verse that she did not participate volitionally. It says in the next sentence, and when she had purified herself from her uncleanness, she returned to her home. A legitimate sexual encounter is not considered biblically to be unclean, and there is no purification required. Bathsheba obviously considered this to be an illegitimate union. She considered herself unclean. She considered herself to have been violated, and she therefore took the liberty of cleansing herself, which according to Leviticus 15:18 would be to take a bath. And after she had her ablution, she went back, it says,
to her home. It was David's misuse of his authority that brought Bathsheba to his castle where he raped her. 2 Samuel 11, verse 4. Point 2. It was his misuse of authority that caused the murder of her husband Uriah. No need for exegesis here. Let's just note it from the scriptures. I have the New American Standard. 2 Samuel 11, verses 14 through 17. Now it came about in the morning that David wrote a letter to Joab, that's his general of the army, and sent it by the hand of Uriah. Uriah obviously is one of the military officers in the army of Israel. And he had written in the letter saying, place Uriah in the front line of the fiercest battle, and then withdraw from him so that he may be struck down and die. Now this is a setup. David is making sure that Uriah dies. He purposefully places him in the most, the fiercest area of the battle, so that it would be ensured that he die in conflict. And so it was as Joab kept watch on the city, that he put Uriah at the place where he knew there were valiant men, their best fighters. And the men of the city went out and fought against Joab, and some of the people among David's servants fell, some of the men in the army. Uriah the Hittite also died. So it was David's misuse of authority that caused the murder of her husband Uriah. 2 Samuel 11, 14 through 17. Point 3. It was his misuse of authority that caused his daughter, Tamar, to be placed into a compromising situation in the castle of her half-brother Amnon. That's 2 Samuel 13, and we will note verses 4 through 7 to get the context. Verse 4, and he said to him, that might be better to start at 3, you find out who the pronouns are. Amnon had a friend whose name was Jonadab, the son of Shimei, David's brother. So this is David's nephew. And Jonadab was a very shrewd man. And he said to him, that's Amnon, O son of the king, why are you so depressed morning after morning? Will you not tell me? Then Amnon said to him, I am in love with Tamar, the sister of my brother Absalom. I am in love with Tamar. We better be translated. I am under the assault of the SWAT team, and I am in sexual arrogance. As well as criminal arrogance, by the way. He's going to rape her. That's criminal arrogance, not sexual arrogance. We have both working here. That's fine. Jonadab then said to him, lie down on your bed and pretend to be sick. When your father comes to see you, say to him, please let my sister Tamar come and give me some food to eat, and let her prepare the food in my sight, that I may see it and eat from her hand. Now, he's sick in his bed in his castle. David's going to pay a call. He's going to say, why are you here in bed? Are you ill? Yes, I'm ill, but I might feel better if my sister Tamar came and prepared some food for me, fixed it right here in the room with me so I can watch her. Now, what's his implication here? I'm the crown prince, and I do have to be careful about who manages my food. So I do need to keep an eye on it. And what would that say to David? There are no romantic intentions here. He wants someone who obviously is a good cook to come in and fix him something that will help him feel better, and he likes Tamar's cooking. So I'm going to send her over here and get this all fixed up for him. It'll all be here, and he can watch her fix it so he won't feel like he's in danger of being assassinated. Verse 6. So Amnon lay down and pretended to be ill. And when the king came to see him, Amnon said to the king, Please let my sister Tamar come and make me a couple of cakes in my sight that I may eat from her hand. And then verse 7. Then David sent to the house of And then David sent to the house for Tamar, saying, Go now to your brother Amnon's house and prepare food for him, which he did, and you know the rest of that story. It was his misuse of authority that caused his daughter Tamar to be placed into a compromising situation in the castle of her half-brother Amnon. 2 Samuel 13, let's say verses 3 through 7. Point 4. It was David's misuse of authority that caused a miscarriage of justice to occur in the adjudication of Tamar's charge of rape against Amnon. It was his misuse of authority that caused have developed it not only from the Hebrew but also the Greek of the Septuagint. Now when King David heard all these things, he became extremely angry. But he did not trouble the life of Amnon his son because he loved him and because he was his firstborn. And then number 5, it was David's failure to use his authority that allowed Amnon to enter into a situation which required condition red, while assuming it was condition white. It was David's failure to use his authority that allowed Amnon to enter into a situation which required condition red, while assuming it was condition white. 2 Samuel 13, verse 27. Now, I guess that all of these 5 things could be construed as simple bureaucratic snafus. But I would contend to you that David has continuously misused or failed to use his authority. This man has been delegated the position of king of Israel. He is to execute justice for the law. And he has failed to do that on many occasions. On other occasions, he has violated the law, while on others, he has failed to use his authority at all for the benefit of the kingdom. Do you see the message that is sent to the young men of Israel? It's been 2 years now. The message sent to the young men of Israel is this: all women are fair game in the nation Israel. The crown prince can get away with it, then why can't I? We don't know the outcome to that, but it's not a good message to send, even if not one woman was violated as a result. It's not a good message for the leadership of a country to send the message that it is okay to violate women. Why is character not an issue in the leadership of a nation? Why is it all right for the leader to violate law after law after law, sending a message to the youth of the land that, well, the king does it, why is it not okay for me to do it? If he can get away with it by simply bold-faced lying, why can't I get away with it by simply bold-faced lying? It didn't happen. I wasn't there. I don't remember. We see David's failure to use his authority to protect the crown prince. In 2 Samuel 13, 27, in corrected translation it reads, But when Absalom kept pressing David, he let Amnon accompany all his sons and go with him. Analysis now, point 1. David is blinded by liberal dreams of brotherhood, multiculturalism, and ethnic harmony. David is blinded by dreams of brotherhood, multiculturalism, and ethnic harmony, all brought about because the brothers have decided to get together for a barbecue at Baal Hazor. The brothers, my sons, are going to get together for a barbecue at Baal Hazor, up at the ranch.
Hazer. Interesting word in the Hebrew. This is the Hebrew word translated into the English, village. David is thinking, it just takes a village. That's what will bring harmony to the royal household. Brotherhood. I'll send my boys up for a barbecue and they can get together and they can have rapport around the little bonfire. Well, what would make me say these things? Well, we have analysis here coming up that shows you that David's running a United Nations right there in Jerusalem. It's called his family. We'll see. Point two. This is a 10th century mixture of Woodstock, a Shakespearean tragedy, and a family reunion. No good can come from this. 10th century B.C. mixture. We've got Woodstock, a Shakespearean tragedy, and a family reunion around the bonfire. Three. All the brothers are half-Jewish through David. But Amnon's mother is a Jezreelite, Kileab's mother is a Carmelite, and Absalom's mother is from Geshur. So there's three half-breeds there from different cultural backgrounds. Point four. The other three older brothers were from Hebron, and God only knows what ethnic background they were. I say God only knows because the diversity, that's a nice 20th century, 1990s word, the diversity of Hebron as an ancient city is well known and documented. I quote to you from the Erdman's Bible Dictionary, edited by Alan C. Myers, page 476. This is commentary on the city of Hebron. Initially called Kiriath Arba, translated City of Four. So originally there were four cities very closely associated to each other called Kiriath Arba, and later became known as Hebron. Initially called Kiriath Arba, the name suggests an ancient confederation of neighboring cities originally founded circa 1700 B.C. Now this is in the south of Israel. It became more or less a stop on routes coming out of Egypt, moving into the Fertile Crescent. Therefore, there were a lot of nationalities that moved through the area. And so, Myers goes on to add, as a Canaanite royal city, Hebron exhibited the ethnic diversity of pre-Israelite Palestine. Its inhabitants included the legendary Anakim. The Anakim. You remember when the first generation of Jews tried to go in and take a look at the land, and they sent this G2 squad in there to find out what was going on. And they came back just absolutely dumbstruck with fear because of the giants in the land. And only Caleb and Joshua had the courage to say, well, let's go take them. Everybody else said, no, we don't need to do that. They're giants. Well, these are the Anakim. And a derivation of the Anakim leads to Goliath. Goliath was sort of a spinoff of that. And Goliath, as you know, was over 9 feet tall. And that's why the word legendary here. That's why they're legendary. So the inhabitants included the legendary Anakim, Ammonite, Hittite, and Canaanite. So what were the last three wives of David? Some kind of mixy-matchy deal here out of Hebron. So point five. Six sons and a daughter, Tamar, was not a very large family in that day. But David had taken on a great deal more than these, and in all, along with being king, it was more than he could bear. David. I did a little research. Someone reminded me the other day that David had a wife before Ahinoam. It was Michal, who was a daughter of Saul, but he didn't have any children by her. I don't know how that happened, but anyway, didn't have any children by her. And then you move into the six wives that he actually married before he moved his capital to Jerusalem. And of those six wives, he had a total of 22 children, when you add Bathsheba to the mix. Now, that's actually eight wives when you count Michael, seven who bore children. So he had 22 children by these seven wives. Then we go to other passages. We know he had at least 10 concubines. Well, if the percentages hold up, he's going to have at least 22 or more children by these 10 concubines. So that's how you get the estimate of around 50 children. So he's got 50 kids. He's got eight wives. He's got at least 10 concubines. All these kids running around. He's commander-in-chief of the Israeli army. He's chief justice of the Supreme Court. He's king of the country. He's got all he can do and say grace over it. And when it comes to being a good father and teaching his son how to grow up and be aristocrat and to mind their manners in genteel society, he has to delegate that down. And who do you delegate it down to? You delegate it down to mama, except there are seven mamas involved, plus 10 what you might call surrogate mamas. So he had six sons and a daughter. That's not a very large family, but he had taken on a great deal more than these, and along with being king, it was more than he could bear. His other children and wives are not all known, but we do get an enlarged family tree in 2 Samuel 5, verses 13 through 16. Here's a bit of an enlarged family tree. These are the ones that are named. Not all of them are named. 2 Samuel 5:13. David took more concubines and wives from Jerusalem after he came from Hebron, and more sons and daughters were born to David. Verse 14. Now these are the names of those who were born to him in Jerusalem: Shemua, Shobab, Nathan, and Solomon. Verse 15. Ibhar, Elishua, Nethig, Japhiah. Verse 16. Elishama, Eliada, and Eliphelet. Then we see in 2 Chronicles 3, verse 9, all these were sons of David, besides the sons of the concubines, and Tamar was their sister. Point 6. Obviously, David created more than he could administrate as a father, and therefore all his sons were basically raised by their mothers. Seven. This resulted in each one being raised in accordance with his mother's ethnic, cultural, social, educational, and economic background. When you're raised by your mother and your father has minimal input, then whatever her ethnic, cultural, social, educational, and economic background happens to be, that zeitgeist is going to be transmitted into the long-term memory traces of her child. That's not necessarily bad. I'm not implying that it's bad. I'm telling you that's what's happening here. Now, if they were all of the same culture, do we have a problem? No, we don't. But every child David has in this first set has a different cultural background on his mother's side. And they're learning this from the mother. David has no input. Eight. They were brothers by blood to their father, but through their mothers they were of different nationalities and thus different culturally, with different lifestyles and different behavior patterns. These brothers were brothers, but different in every sense of the word. Now, you know how much turmoil you parents do can be found under one roof when blood brothers get together. When they try to agree on anything, warfare breaks out. And this is when they are related on both sides of the family, to the same mama and the same daddy. What if you bring in this cultural, ethnic, multi-whatever mix?
and then there's no parental input from the father's side, and the mothers are left to deal with it, they're going to communicate what they know. So they were brothers by blood to their father, but through their mothers they were of different nationalities, and thus different culturally, with different lifestyles and different behavior patterns. Point nine. It was a multiculturalist dream family, but it was a nightmare when it came to the issues of brotherhood and harmony. The multiculturalist dream family, but it is a nightmare to have these guys try to associate with each other and build rapport. There will be no brotherhood, and there is no harmony. 10. Amnon is Jezreelite hoi polloi. Absalom is both Jewish and Geshurite royalty. Amnon was raised by a commoner. Absalom by a princess. Amnon is nouveau riche with middle class manners. Absalom is old money with upper class savoir faire. There's no harmony here. There's not going to be any brotherhood in that pair, obviously, from our passage. So to repeat the distinctions between the two antagonists here. Amnon is Jezreelite hoi polloi. Absalom is both Jewish and Geshurite royalty. Amnon was raised by a commoner, Absalom by a princess. Amnon is nouveau riche with middle class manners. Absalom is old money with upper class savoir faire. Point 11. The older brothers fall somewhere between the two in upbringing, social graces, and cultural background. The other brothers fall somewhere between the two in upbringing, social graces, and cultural background. David, therefore, has created a blood-related melting pot. And he hopes they can just all get together and love one another around the bonfire. This is why he thinks it's great and puts his blessings on the whole deal. You know, I've got this multicultural mix here. There's discord among the brethren, so to speak. And Absalom's going to have a party, and he's invited all my boys to go up there and sit around the bonfire and have a grand time up on the ranch. And brotherhood will break out once they get there. So sure, it's a fine idea. I offer my blessing. Point 12, David is out of touch. Not only is David out of touch, what Robert Bork calls the elite, who Thomas Sowell calls the elite, have invented a monster that has been force-fed to the current generation, and it is balkanizing this country. It is separating us into varied cultures, and we ultimately must come into conflict. It inevitably occurs throughout history, and we are creating a monster which cannot be fed. It will be insatiable once it breaks free, and there will be no way to contain it. And we'll learn more about it later. But this is an issue here for David. He tries to solve it with getting everybody together around the bonfire, hoping brotherhood will break out among multi-ethnic children. He's out of touch. His sons are members of a multicultural stew who, if not in social discord, are ethnically and culturally diverse and thus have no rapport. There is no rapport because they think differently. They've been raised differently. They're ethnically different. They're socially and culturally different. They think differently. How can you have rapport in such a group? It is a multicultural 13. There can be no harmony among such a group of people, regardless of what the elitist harmonizers of our day say, and regardless of what David dreams. There can be no harmony among such a group of people. 14. What is needed is discipline and authority, which forces people to organize around a set of established and inflexible norms and standards. What is needed is discipline and authority. This forces people to organize. Organization is the issue. You're going to have peace and harmony, you must have organization first. So you must organize, and that organization must be set around established and inflexible norms and standards. There are certain standards to which society submits that must be inflexible if the society is to survive. You may not take the law into your own hands. You may not become involved in political murder. That's revolution, coups d'etat, etc. You may not violate the sanctity of a woman's home and her body. You may not violate the privacy of individuals. You may not miscarry justice willy-nilly throughout the Commonwealth and expect people to stay organized and respect the law. You may not do these things as a nation and survive. You may not assault the divine institution. You may not turn marriage into a scheme by which perversion can find legitimacy. You cannot assault the household, the family, and parents, and then speak of community. You cannot dismantle our military establishment and destroy respect for duly appointed authority and expect us to be able to go on defending our shores with efficiency. We need discipline and authority, and it must be centered around established standards which are inflexible. Some things are malleable, but some are not. 15. Harmony is based on compromise, which is born in conflict. First you have conflict, then you have compromise, then you have harmony. You just can't have harmony. Somebody's got to compromise. And what if the thing that must be compromised is an inflexible absolute? And I will not bend. I will not recant. I will not change the way I think. This is blazoned in stone as far as I am concerned.
What if the individual says that?
There will be no harmony between he and one who disagrees. And when you have multicultural mixes, multicultural ethnic groups, multicultural societies coming in together, and someone says we must have community, they're daydreaming. It's not going to happen. Why? Because certain cultures have absolute standards that they will not compromise. Right or wrong is not the issue here. It's the way people are. And you take culture A, they have standards they will not allow to fluctuate. Same with culture B. They're in conflict. How can there be harmony? I will bring an example, second session, from Judge Robert H. Bork. He gives examples of how Arabs of the Muslim persuasion have moved into the country, and they are in total and complete opposition to our culture, our way of life, our system of laws, everything we stand for and hold to be dear. And they are not going to change. That's fine. They don't want to change. They're not going to change. But they've moved here. Now, that creates a cultural clash. And I know a lot of people have had a lot of heavy-duty things to say about this fellow, Pat Buchanan. Some are legitimate, some aren't. But one thing he said that is absolutely gospel truth, there is a cultural war going on in this country. And the reason for it is we've been force-fed multiculturalism. We're not protecting our borders. We're not assimilating immigrants. And as a result of that, we're balkanizing. And our cultural clash is eventually going to spill blood. It's already begun. Harmony is based on compromise, which is born in conflict. It's nice when you have it, but not at the expense of principle. Who will compromise principle in order to have harmony? The weak, the malleable, the pusillanimous, those who will believe anything in order just to get along. Rather die than get along when it means sacrificing principle. That's why wars break out. People are willing to die to stand up for what they believe in. 16. Whenever one or more of those involved in a controversy, and the controversy can be social, political, religious, or cultural. Whenever one or more of those involved in a controversy become arrogant, then peace and harmony can never occur. And every special interest group in this country and every ethnic group in this country are organized and led by arrogant people. And therefore, whatever compromise is going to be had will be at the point of a sword. 17. Order is the only workable environment in which such diversity can function. An establishment of order demands discipline and authority and one culture. Repeat. Order is the only workable environment in which such diversity can function, and establishment of order demands discipline and authority and one culture. A dissertation on multiculturalism from Judge Robert H. Bork will begin our second session at 15:45.